This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Got a huge helicopter going overhead. We are good at it. We're just going to shout over it. Whose idea is this?
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, favored to go all the way to the Final Four, Heritage Foundation's Lindsay Burke.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you, Lindsay. Thanks. Your first time on the show.
It is.
And we're trying something new today. We are rooftop, baby. We're on the rooftop of the Fordham Institute offices.
Right.
We've got helicopters flying overhead. We've got motorcades. We've got but a nice view. We can see the
gorgeous
White House
view
and the NEA at the same time.
Which says a lot.
Which says a lot. We like to keep an eye on it. I swear that helicopter, you don't think that's Marine One, Producer Joe? Nope. I can't tell. The president's supposed to be in Ohio by now. What's going on? Well, this is exciting, Lindsay. We have a lot to talk about today. We're going to do some Pardon the Gadfly playing that isn't just about the week's news, some of that, but also about some of the bigger education debates that have gone on in the last couple of months, including a few issues where we might not quite see eye to eye, even though I have to say we agree on quite a lot when it comes to federal education policy. All right, so let's get started. Ty, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Next month, Achieve Incorporated will release the first draft of its next generation science standards. How should they handle climate science?
Climate science, global warming, global climate change. Lindsay, we've done some studies of state standards, and this is something that they are very careful about. Sometimes just ignore it entirely because they don't want to infuriate people on the left or right. What do you think? What's the right approach here?
Well, you know, I think the right approach is whatever the particular states want the approach to be. And so, you know, and I think this is where we would disagree a little bit. We're seeing this push for more kind of nationalization of education is the way I see it. You've got the Common Core push. They've got their ELA standards and math standards. And I think it's no small coincidence that now we're seeing, and granted, this is the National Research Council that's putting out these science standards. But, you know, we're seeing this push across the board to really nationalize the content that's taught in local schools. And, you know, goodness, I said earlier I brought props with me. Had these national standards been set back in 1977 when Time magazine published their How to Survive the Coming Ice Age, I think we would have a whole different set of standards being promoted. So, you know, I think ultimately it's something that we do have to leave up to the states to decide.
Yeah. So, and if we're we've got a huge helicopter going overhead. You know, we hear these things inside, but they don't seem this loud. That looks like some kind of army helicopter. What is that, Ty? All right, well.
That's okay. We're good at improvising.
We are good at it. We're just going to shout over it.
Right.
Whose idea was this? All right, so understood you've got the concern on the national standards. And this is, I should point out, Lindsay, of course, even the science piece, it is still state-led. We've
Absolutely.
Got states coming together voluntarily. Right now, 26 states, so fewer than on the math and English side. And we'll see what they think. And no doubt, just as with state standards, this climate change issue, as well as evolution, are two hot-button issues. That kind of. So say you're just writing state standards. What do you think? What should states be encouraging schools to teach about climate science?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. And ultimately, I think we can't think about it on that level. We have to think about it in terms of kind of the macro argument. If you have a school that is teaching climate science and you disagree with the way in which they're teaching that science, ultimately, it comes down to choice, right? And you think about the kind of big thinkers on this issue. Rick Hess has done great work on kind of the choice down to the credit level, allowing parents to really choose not only among schools, but among coursework. Right? Look at what Louisiana is doing. This is the anecdote. How do we get to a place where parents can ultimately craft an education that is completely customized to meet their child's learning needs? And if they are unhappy with the climate science that's being taught in their local school, they should be able to take their share of dollars to any school in any class of their choice for that matter. So I don't even argue it out on the school level about what's taught in each particular school on the science standards, but what do we do at the macro level?
But it does sound
ultimately
like then,
it's choice.
So you're not really just against national standards. You'd really be against state standards as well.
You know, I think those standards are best that are kind of crafted at the local level. So yes, there is an argument to be made that standards should be set locally. But yes, certainly state standards are a better step than national standards, and we don't want to see that ultimately put in federal hands. And this is where we're moving. And we thought about getting into a debate on national standards. And, you know, I do think that when we look at all of the incentives, the various carrots and sticks, that this administration has attached the national standards push to the Common Core, it has moved from what was perhaps at one point Common Core and voluntary, but now really has turned into a national push to really centralize the content taught in local schools.
Okay, the Heritage Foundation against state standards. Okay, Ty, question number two.
Last month, President Obama submitted his education budget request to Congress, including a proposed $1.7 billion increase to the Education Department's budget. Are the president's education spending priorities on point?
I expect you to say yes to this one, right, Lindsay?
Absolutely not. And what's really interesting, and I would say disingenuous even, about the president's budget is that it doesn't end there, right? You've got a $69.8 billion budget for the Department of Ed that's being proposed. And on top of that, you have these huge new spending increases proposed in the president's blueprint. And this blueprint includes a $25 billion, we'll call it a public education bailout, to prevent teachers from being laid off. Which, you know, they did this before 2 years ago with the EdJobs bill. They did it with $100 billion in stimulus money that the department got. And on top of that, you have this $30 billion school modernization fund that they're also promoting in this blueprint. So it doesn't just end with these huge increases in the department's budget with that $70 billion. There is so much more spending. So, you know, across the board, we're seeing the administration do what they've done to a huge degree, which is to increase the federal role. And, of course, it's not just this administration. President Bush doubled the Department of Education's budget, but we're seeing this kind of failed policy of continuing to increase federal spending and programs continue.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Of course, this is just an election year document because nobody expects any action on this before the election. They'll be going out there and talking about how they want to increase spending and the Republicans want to reduce spending. Right. And then we'll see if something gets done in the lame duck Congress after the election.
Yeah, but there is one place they're cutting. I'll just interject, and that's the D.C. voucher program. You know, you've got this $70 billion Department of Ed budget and this little $20 million voucher program is singled out. And, of course, they're not actually cutting the money. They're just putting it in the D.C. public school system school budget. So it really shows, you know, President Obama said budgets are about priorities and choices. Well, this shows exactly where his priorities lie.
Yes, his priority is getting reelected. I think we agree on that one, Lindsay. Okay, topic number three.
With the Klein ESEA reauthorization bills passed out of committee, will Congress make any progress on education legislation in the near future?
All right, so what's your read on this, Lindsay? You guys have been pushing the A-plus bill for a couple years now, which I guess I would say is somewhat to the right of the Klein bills.
I would say that that's correct, that it is somewhat to the right. And, of course, we've been educating members on the efficacy of allowing states to opt out and really direct their resources in a way that would best meet student needs. You know, the Klein proposals are a good first step. They do allow states more flexibility, schools more flexibility with how they spend their dollars. But ultimately, I think this states would be far better served by being able to completely opt out and not an opt out the way President Obama wants to have states opt out, which is to condition that opt out through strings attached waivers and really centralizing control further at the Department of Ed. So I think we are kind of at a tipping point right now. We're seeing Harkin, you're seeing a lot of people in Congress really say that we're at a stalemate, that this is a Republican only proposal, which I don't think is the case. It might be the case technically right now, but I think that there is bipartisan support for the idea that states should have more flexibility with how they spend resources.
And look, my own view is that if the House bill can pass on the floor of the House, and then the Senate's bill, the Harkin-Enzi bill, could get to the floor of the Senate and pass, then we'd have a conference committee and we'd sit down and really hammer this thing out. Now, the end result would surely be something to the left of the Klein bills. It would have to be in order to get any, and the strategy would be to get bipartisan support at that point. You'd probably lose some of the Tea Party votes, and you would not get as much flexibility as you'd like, but at least we'd get the law reauthorized and put the kibosh on these waivers.
And I think this is, we'll disagree a little bit here on kind of the ultimate goal, right? I mean, do we want a ninth reauthorization of ESEA? And I think ultimately what we want is an opt-out completely. You know, do we need another reauthorization? It hasn't served students well for the past 4.5 decades
All right,
or so.
But Lindsay, that's not likely to happen anytime soon, if ever.
Such an optimist.
It's such an optimist. And so the question is, will the Republicans in the House say getting a bill done, even if it means something that is not as flexible as we like, we lose some Tea Party members, but at least gets it done so that Arne Duncan doesn't remain the czar of our education system?
You know, I think that they're not ready to settle yet, and I don't think they should be ready to settle. Where the focus should be right now is on an administration that is running afoul of three federal laws when it comes to them supporting national standards and tests. The waiver process, which is circumventing the normal legislative process by granting these waivers to states with conditions attached. And sure, the secretary has waiver authority under ESEA, but to attach conditions to those waivers is really, you know, akin to a reauthorization through executive fiat. So that's a big problem. And I think that conservatives in Congress are rightly focused on pushing back against the administration and are rightly focused on kind of that bright line in the sand of A+ and allowing states some true flexibility.
All right. Thank you, Lindsay, for playing part in the gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
Amber, did you fill out your bracket?
No, I deleted that email. I know nothing about brackets. Nada.
Amber, I know nothing about basketball.
Nothing. Right, so you're just going to take wild guess?
Part of team building around the office. Teasing.
Guess.
Anyways, our rules are if you come in last, you get your $5 back. And I always have a pretty good shot at that.
Yeah, right? I guess I could have approached it with that spirit. I just want to excel at everything, Mike.
You know, Arne Duncan, he did pick his alma mater, Harvard, over Vanderbilt.
Hmm.
Trying to get some kind of bet cooked up between the secretary and Lamar Alexander for their alma maters. I thought they'd be fun. I always like it when, you know, politicians have bets over these sorts of things.
Yeah,
have a chance to be bipartisan, you know, show their more human side.
I agree.
But so far, one of Arnie's people said, yes, it would be bipartisan, but it would not be win-win. That was a pretty good joke.
That was pretty good.
Yeah. All right,
Amber, at all.
What you got for us this week?
All right, we got a new study out, albeit flawed, I'll say that from the beginning, by researchers at Montana and Georgia State, examines whether shortening the school week to 4 days impacts student performance. Obviously, we're in an age of budget cuts, and schools and districts are looking to cut via a variety of measures. Whittling down the school week has been a popular strategy, especially in Colorado, New Mexico, Wyoming, mainly rural states and sparsely populated places. Anyway, analysts used school-level performance data in Colorado from 2000 to 2010 for reading and math, focusing on fourth-grade reading and fifth-grade math. In a nutshell, they find that scores on math achievement tests increased by roughly 12% after the switch to a four-day week schedule. Impact on reading is also positive, but smaller in magnitude. They do not analyze what about the four-day week schedule might be advancing achievement. Everybody always wants to get in that black box, but these studies don't do that. Unfortunately, this is an important question, but I think it suffered from a few design flaws. I won't get into too much of the weeds, but basically there was not a comparison group. I'm talking over the airplane people. Sorry, can you still hear me?
It's definitely Marine One, right? I think for sure that is the president's helicopter.
President is hovering over as I'm talking about four-day weeks. Anyway, so some design flaws. Comparison group was huge. They talk about it in the descriptive study, but not actually in the model. They treat four-day school like it's a school-level decision as opposed to a district-level variable. So that basically increases your sample size, which also increases the likelihood of finding a statistically significant finding. I could go on with some other stuff, but bottom line is it's not a well-designed study. But, I mean, I started thinking about it. You know, there are all these other positive outcomes that they list in the beginning, like other studies have shown it's better attendance for teachers and students. It's increased instructional time on the 4 days they're actually there, improved teacher and student morale, better behavior. So I guess I just come down on if it's no harm to students and this study doesn't show that, then maybe we shouldn't be worried too much about it.
You know, we've both had the opportunity at times to go on TV and other places to debate this issue. Mm-hmm. And I've been skeptical. I mean, it just on its face seems like a bad idea to have kids in school less. And now what people sometimes say...
Yes, Mike, let us hear it.
Yes. Hello, Mr. President.
Let's pick it up from the end of Amber's.
Did we forget?
We thought about it.
Why are they just hovering around? Like, he's not here.
He doesn't like my message.
He doesn't either. Try to jet it. Try to try us out. You won't silence us.
All right, we're going to pick it up from the end of Amber's study.
Yeah.
So Mike's going to go.
So, look, we both had a chance to debate this at different times on TV, mm-hmm. other places. Just on his face, seems like a bad idea to have kids in school for less time, particularly when there's other ways to cut the budget that's not so harmful to
but
kids.
It's not necessarily less time is what I'm saying. I mean, there sometimes they add on to those four other days, right. You know, so, and there have been other, I mean, I didn't realize it, but there's been quite a bit of work on this that kind of shows other positive outcomes that aren't necessarily, you know, student achievement, which is what we care the most about. But.
All right, and I guess it all depends on what they're doing on Friday, right? Mm-hmm. You know, what kind of burden does this put on the parents? You know, just how do they, I mean, how do parents handle this?
Yeah,
parents
that's
are working.
Right.
What do they do to arrange, you know, is it, these kids are from small towns and they're able to find other adults around who can keep an eye mm-hmm. on them? I mean, I don't know. It's
a 12% increase in math performance. I mean, that is unparalleled in right. most policy prescriptions.
Yeah,
so
that seems
pretty
a little
incredible,
suspicious.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know. So what do you think, Lindsay? I mean, maybe should we say, look, again, it's a local thing. If parents and educators are cool with it, we shouldn't poo-poo it?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think it's a local decision. And, you know, I think as we start thinking in terms of moving away from seat time regulations and toward completion, that this is something that we should think about. You know, mm-hmm. is it just keeping a kid in a seat for 5 days a week? And so I think, you know, ultimately the study might be flawed, but it mm-hmm. does start to move us away from thinking in terms of seat time regulations and ultimately toward that wonderful utopia that we all hope happens with a combination of choice and online learning.
Right.
And you like it. You notice how Lindsay, I mean, they're so well trained over at Harry.
It all goes back
to their talking
yes,
points.
That's right.
I love it. I
People
love
have
it.
Accused
all
us of that, too. All roads lead to, you know, where.
Hey, it's a discipline. It's an art form.
But yeah, no, I mean, I kind of, not that I was won over because it was not a well-designed study, but when I started reading the lit review section and just seeing all these other sort of positive things, I mean, attendance is kind of big, right? I mean, higher attendance because kids, you know, aren't coming on, you know.
Four days a week.
And then, you know, all the extracurricular stuff, the games, they schedule all that stuff on Fridays. Parents tend to schedule, you know, doctor's appointments and everything. I mean, you just, you reprogram your life, I guess, when your kids got off on Fridays, so.
Yeah. All
anyway.
Right. Wow. Well, thank you, Amber. Thank
You're
you,
welcome.
Lindsay. You know,
thank
we,
you.
As we announced last time, Chris Irvine is no longer with us, which means, what's up with that? Is now in the dustbin of history. But we pay homage to it. Thank you for joining us on this special outdoor edition of the Education Gadfly Show
the
podcast.
Helicopter flyover and all.
I don't know, Joe, if we'd say it was a complete success, but it was definitely different. And
experimenting.
And
we're
experimenting,
all about.
Yes. We do believe in innovation around here. Till next week.
I'm Lindsay Burke.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.